Health. Health. Healthcare with a commitment to human kindness and a belief in the healing power of humanity at HelloHumanKindness.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yesterday, for the seventh or eighth week in a row, I've lost count now, protesters went to Raleigh and crowded into the General Assembly building to express their displeasure with the legislature. And once again, there were arrests. There were 600 arrests yesterday, along with, I think, about, 1,000 now or 5,000, 3,000 people? I can't how many people have been arrested? I can't remember.
The total so far is 550 to 600.
550. Okay. Well, it's 600 yesterday, I believe. So there you go. Along with the fact that a few weeks ago, the Charlotte Observer's Tim Funk, who was assigned to cover the protests, was also arrested. Governor McCrory and others in North Carolina government have characterized these protesters as being outsiders, but news outlets have discovered that as many as 98% of them are from North Carolina. These gatherings have taken place on what have come to be known as Moral Mondays because of what the demonstrators are protesting: voter ID legislation, hydraulic fracking, cuts to education spending, and the rejection of Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, all being put forward by the Republican-controlled legislature and supported in large part by Republican Governor Pat McCrory. Protesters say these legislative moves are immoral because they hurt those who need help the most, as well as the citizens of North Carolina in general, while benefiting moneyed interests. And they complain that the legislature isn't listening to the people. So today, we're going to talk about the goals and methods of this protest movement, what kind of impact they've had and are likely to have going forward, and meet one of the participants who has been arrested. We'll meet him later in the program. But first, Dr. Eric Heberlig and Dr. Michael Bitzer join us. Dr. Heberlig is Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. Good to see you again.
Here, Mike.
Dr. Bitzer is Department Chair and Associate Professor of Politics and History at Catawba College. He's also WFAE's political blogger for our Party Line blog, and in his spare time is Acting Provost of Catawba College. Good to see you as well.
Good morning.
What precipitated these protests?
Well, the Republican legislature now has large majorities, veto-proof majorities, and a Republican governor to sign their legislation. So they've been very aggressive in pushing a national conservative agenda that overturns decades of policy in North Carolina. So it's to those of Democratic persuasions who have traditionally had protection by the state legislature, the policies they favored over the years are now being repealed, and they're reacting strongly to that.
Where were they in November?
Overwhelmed. and it wasn't that they didn't turn out. It's that their turnout is largely in urban areas, which concentrates their votes in relatively few districts, particularly after last year's redistricting, which very much drew the lines to benefit the Republicans.
Yeah. Very much so. I mean, the stacking of the deck through redistricting basically insulated and gave the Republicans an insurance policy. I mean, they actually added seats in both the House and the Senate after the 2012 election. So, you know, they've got the numbers. The Democrats, yeah, in the General Assembly, they can put up a storm and they can try and stop things. They just get overwhelmed. And so really, what other recourse do progressives, do liberals, do does the Democratic Party have, but other than raise awareness, raise attention, and, you know, show that their side is indeed fighting the good fight?
Let me go back and correct something I said at the very beginning of the program, because the numbers were in flux yesterday when I wrote this opening. It was 84 arrests. It actually became more than 100.
120.
For a total of about 600 overall. So let's make that clear. Was there a particular entity, a particular organization, a particular person who was the spearhead of starting these protests?
The director, the leader of the state chapter of the NAACP, Reverend Barber, is really kind of the point person and has really been aggressive and been the leadership of this kind of activity. You know, the first day that they had it, they only had 17 people show up. But now they're drawing crowds of anywhere from, you know, 1,500 to well over 2,000, and it just seems to keep getting larger and larger. And so the clergy have certainly brought in that impact. A lot of it is folks from the Raleigh area, Durham, that area, but they're starting to get folks from across the state coming in and exercising their constitutional right to assemble and to petition their government.
Why then did the governor say these are all outsiders?
It's his attempt to marginalize the demands of the protesters. To say they're outsiders means that, well, we have no real reason to listen to them or take their petitions.
But in a world where we have media of all kinds now, and by media I include the Twitterverse and things like that, where things like that can be quickly disputed and proven to be inaccurate, why would he take that path?
Because he's talking to the Republican audience to say that they want to claim that they're listening to public opinion as legislators, but they're listening to their public, the people who vote for them.
What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that in that it's only part of the public. However, it's not necessarily majority public opinion. And the legislature doesn't necessarily have to go with the majority, it's their way of saying we don't have to listen to the majority because they're not the people who voted for us.
Is this the majority?
It's always dangerous to say what the majority of the
exactly.
public believes,
yeah.
Because most of the public doesn't pay very close attention or have a clear sense of what the policy options are.
And when the shoe was on the other foot, because the Democrats were in control since 1870, I believe, did we have similar demonstrations ever from Republicans or conservatives who felt that the Democrats were pushing the envelope too far in the liberal direction?
I think nationally you can look back at the Tea Party.
Okay.
In 2009, 2010.
Wasn't that a national movement as opposed to a state movement?
It was, but it certainly had the grassroots organization and impact. I mean, the Tea Party likes to describe themselves as individual enclaves, basically small groups that aren't really overseen by a large umbrella organization. Now, there are some that have gotten funded from establishment Republican operations, but in general, what they see is as a grassroots organizing event and activity. And they certainly made their presence known on Capitol Hill when the Obamacare legislation was coming to fruition, particularly in the House. There was a lot of people who got arrested outside of Speaker Pelosi's office. They were shouting outside of Capitol Hill, kill the bill, much to, being led on by members of the Republican conference. To do that. So we certainly see this whenever a group feels threatened by the party in power. My belief is that is always easier to get them energized and organized than it is to necessarily say, hey, you're in power. Okay, yay. Okay, go ahead and do whatever you want to do as long as we're in power. But if you're not, and the issues and the options, the legislation is impacting you, you're going to feel threatened, and that's going to be an energizing force.
Well, and I think the other element of that is that the Democratic Party in North Carolina that had been in charge for over a century wasn't a Nancy Pelosi Democratic Party. I mean, it was very moderate nationally. There was aligned with the business interests, the Chamber of Commerce. So the type of legislation that the North Carolina Democratic Assembly was pushing, wasn't things that were terribly threatening. Right. To conservatives, or at least business elite.
So how would you describe the Republican alignment in the State House today?
It's almost libertarian-oriented on economics. That is, do as little as possible in terms of government services, cut taxes as much as possible, particularly aiming those tax cuts at investors, business owners. The flat tax essentially is where we're headed in terms of an income tax, and aligned with conservative Christian evangelicals in terms of social policy.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, speaking of which, protests are called Moral Mondays. Why? Who coined the term, and is it accurate?
I think it came out of certainly Reverend Barber's approach to this. And one of the key things that I think it is an attempt to frame the issue, to present their grievances in a way that you know, uses faith-based, uses the issues of the Gospels and Christianity to say these policies are hurting the least in our society. And so I think the kind of framing the issue as a moral issue, you know, presents their side in one light and almost forces the other side to have to react to it as well. So I think this is a lot of it is framing in terms of how you present your argument about these issues.
Yeah, if you just say, well, we're a bunch of liberal Democrats who don't like what Republicans are doing, Republicans and independents are going to say, well, that's what we'd expect.
Yeah.
But if you frame it in a way that's broader than that, that there are things that both conservatives and moderates can identify with, and that gives them a reason to take another look and the question what their legislators are doing.
Given that this term evidently was coined by a member of the cloth, how is it that we have a whole subset of evangelical Christians on the right who don't see the issue similarly?
It's, you know, how we interpret the biblical instructions on how to treat the poor. You know, the left sees it as not just individual responsibilities to be compassionate or churches duties to serve the poor, but we as a community through our government should also assist the poor, whereas more conservative-leaning Christians say, no, it's efficient that we as individuals or churches take care of it, and it's not necessary for the government to coerce tax money through us to support causes we may not agree with.
I think ideology and partisanship also come into this. I mean, when you're talking about white evangelicals, they are overwhelmingly identify as conservative and, more importantly, Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you've got this tension within, I think, the faith-based community in different perspectives, but a lot of it has to deal with basic ideological perspectives and partisan perspectives as well.
We talked about Governor McCrory and his reasoning behind calling them outsiders to kind of give them less of a stage and less credence. Protesters are usually in this country, it seems to me, always disparaged in some way for some reason, and yet, and I think you pointed this out in a piece that you wrote for our political blog, Michael, that social movements have often served as outlets for the heat and passion found within the American political system. This is kind of the way the country works, and it started
sure.
this way with the Boston Tea Party, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is kind of our safety valve to let the pressure out. I mean, if you look at other countries, sometimes they have to use bullets and open rebellions and violent protest. You know, yes, people are getting arrested here, but it is nothing like what other countries go through. And I think this is kind of the system that allows for this venting and airing of grievances and concerns to say, this is the way that we handle the pent-up tensions that is oftentimes resulting of, I'm in the minority, I don't have a voice. Well, yes, you do. You have a voice. You have the constitutional protections to exercise that, to assemble, and to petition your government.
But it's people who are knowingly and purposely being arrested.
Yes.
They're doing it to say, I feel so strongly about this, I'm willing to allow the law to sanction me.
This is civil disobedience.
Yeah, this is so wrong. I'm willing to pay those social costs.
But historically, did they have an impact? Did they result in changes of policy, changes of heart?
The civil rights movement suggests that it did, but it was one that people paid those costs over decades.
Lunch counter protests, the attempt to integrate bus lines throughout the South. I mean, those had a lasting impact, and I think is still being drawn on.
We're going to continue this conversation about Moral Mondays, and we're going to meet someone who did protest and was arrested in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Griffin Brothers, providing the Charlotte area with tire and automotive care since 1961. Details about our 9 locations and current offers online at griffinbrothers.com. With school out, lots of teenagers are searching for and working summer jobs. Normally, that means what? Lifeguarding, I suppose, or retail or fast food job, or perhaps caddying at a golf course. But some teenagers in Charlotte have skipped all of the normal avenues of money-making and have turned their passions to profit. They are teen entrepreneurs. How unusual is this? Is this the coming wave, a new phenomenon? We're going to talk about this tomorrow and meet a couple of teen entrepreneurs at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, a new biography of Nikola Tesla, how his invention set the stage for the way we produce and use electricity today.
Join that conversation on the Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in our Spirit Square studio today with Dr. Eric Heberling, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, Associate Professor and Department Chair of Politics and History and the Acting Provost of Catawba College in Salisbury. And as we've said, the Moral Monday demonstrations in Raleigh have resulted in the arrests of more than 600 people in the past 8 weeks. One of those arrested joins us now by phone. Dr. Jedediah Purdy is a professor of law at Duke University. After his arrest, he wrote an article about it in the Huffington Post, and we welcome him to the program from his vacation. Thank you for joining us.
I'm very glad to be here. Not much of a vacation. I'm taking care of my nieces and nephews, okay. But it's really nice.
Okay, well, I'm glad you could take some time to spend it with us here this morning. Why were you arrested? What was the charge?
There were three charges technically, legally, but they came down to staying in the Capitol building with the other people committing civil disobedience after we were ordered to disperse. And in a situation where there were enough of us that we were probably in the way of whatever else might have been going on in the rotunda. I believe the charges were second-degree trespassing, failure to disperse, and violating the rules of the legislative building.
Trespassing, it's a public building. You're a law professor. Can you trespass in a public building?
Yeah, you can. There are rules in public spaces, as there are in private spaces. And the rules in public spaces are limited by the First Amendment right to assemble and petition and speak. But it doesn't mean there are no rules. There's some conversation going on in the background, which I shouldn't say much about and don't know much about a First Amendment challenge to some of the restrictions they've placed on the protesters. But the idea that you can't just do anything you want in the people's house is pretty straightforward legally.
How organized is this? Obviously, you made a personal decision to be civilly disobedient and to be arrested, to place yourself in that sort of jeopardy. Is anybody saying, hey, guys, here's what we're going to do, and everybody follows, or is it strictly individual decisions by individuals?
Well, that's a good question. The way I experienced it is that the NAACP, which has been the organizing node along with a large number of churches in the state for the civil disobedience, urged people who were planning to get arrested to show up a couple of hours early for a legal training session and just sort of get your feet on the ground kind of thing. At a church in Raleigh, the day of the Moral Monday that we were going into the state house, and I think nearly everyone who got arrested that day did so. I certainly did. So, while on the one hand I made a purely personal decision to commit civil disobedience, I think that the occupation of the rotunda is being coordinated through the state NAACP, and they're taking responsibility for providing basic legal support and expertise and bonds when necessary for people who've committed civil disobedience. So I felt that since they were stepping up on this, I should go through their door.
So put us in that rotunda. You and thousands of other people crowd into the rotunda. What's the atmosphere? How do authorities react to that? How do they tell you to leave? And what is your reaction to that order to leave?
So you're in the rotunda wall to wall, because in addition to people planning to be arrested, and I should say this is fairly choreographed, those of us who are planning to be arrested have been wearing distinctly colored armbands since about 4:30 and throughout the protest out in the Capitol grounds, which begins at 5, and we go into the rotunda at about 5:45 after some speaking and singing and the like out in the grounds. We file in two by two, and then after the civil disobedience folks come supporters who fill the rotunda, so it's wall-to-wall, more or less. We're singing. I'm singing very quietly, which has always been my strategy because I can't really. I'm moving my mouth. Some people are singing.
Church.
or the choir, or basically anything other than a loud concert where no one cares. There are some more speeches. These are mostly from folks who just feel called to come forward in the moment. Some are religious, some are very personal, some are about policy and specific bills the legislature is considering. Then after about 25 minutes, the gentleman I take to be the head or chief of the Capitol Police, Capitol Security, makes an announcement through a bullhorn that those who don't leave in 10 minutes will be arrested, because our gathering is in violation of these Capitol rules that I think probably have to do with peace and quiet and not blocking up the corridors. And then there's a 5-minute warning, and at about that time, those who've come in intending to show support but not be arrested begin to leave. Then there's a 2-minute warning. I believe there was another 2-minute warning. I think they were doing their best to make sure that you had the chance to leave if you intended to leave. And then as we continue to sing, one by one, we're approached by the chief of security and one of his officers, informed that we're under arrest, and our hands are placed in zip cuffs, which are plastic handcuffs. They chafe, but they don't have nearly the weight or the quite the sense of authority of a pair of metal cuffs. And after about 10 minutes, 15 minutes of arrest, because they're going through about 90 of us one by one, we are all in the cafeteria basement of the Capitol, where we're held till the next day.
So you're not manhandled by the officials, and you don't fight back, essentially. You voluntarily put your hands behind your back and are cuffed.
Any show of resistance or even disrespect, I think, would be completely out of the spirit of civil disobedience on our part, because the idea is very much that we are peacefully and deliberately submitting to the state's authority.
And it sounds to be choreographed on both sides.
Absolutely. The officers are extremely respectful. They're extremely careful. They know exactly what's going on. I think what people have to appreciate, and what I am happy to say I think nearly everyone involved appreciates, is that this works because both sides have a clear understanding of what it means to commit civil disobedience and what the appropriate limits are. And so it's really a dance with two partners. The police are very much part of this.
You're a professor of law at a major university. How does an arrest of this type impact you personally or professionally, or does it?
Well, I don't know the answer yet. My hope is that, I see it this way. I think committing civil disobedience is less like carjacking than it is like writing a letter to the editor, and in the sense that it's part of how we make our views known to one another. It's really part of the compact that a civilized society makes with itself. And as a professor of constitutional law engaged in the exercise of constitutional rights, I feel I'm doing something that that my colleagues, even if they don't agree, really ought to recognize and respect. I'll say my concern is actually much more for people who are people who can't say that for one reason or another in the jobs that they're working, mm-hmm. or young people who are looking for employment who may face really indiscriminate job discrimination based on their having an arrest record, even though, like I said, I think this is not carjacking.
Because this does give you an arrest record. It goes on what we call your permanent record.
Absolutely.
It takes some explaining, I would think, if you get a chance to explain it, to explain why you were arrested under what circumstances. So those who are not in a tenured professorial position, which you may or may not be, I don't know, may have a little problem with this in their personal lives going forward, which makes this all the more, seems to me, courageous.
I quite agree. And I also think this highlights this highlights how much people are putting on the line, which is just what you said, and I think is very important to observe. I think this is also part of the reason that those arrested skew toward the older and the relatively affluent. The decision to submit to arrest has to be, I think, seen in light of who feels that they can afford to do it, all things considered. And I've talked to a lot of people in their 30s and 20s, basically I'm in my late 30s, so my age and younger, who, looking at the job market, looking at family responsibilities, say, I'm just worried about what it would mean down the road. So I think there are a lot of sympathizers and a lot of people involved who don't think that last step would be safe for them.
Let me bring Drs. Heberlig and Bitzer back into the conversation here. How does that sort of an attitude where I have to protect myself because I'm young and this will give me an arrest record and jobs are tight right now, so I better be careful, so I'm not going to do this even though I believe in it. How demographically speaking, how were other protests conducted? Because, you know, the youth protests, the anti-Vietnam protests, mm-hmm. even the civil rights protests of the 60s seem to be youth-based.
Very much so. And, you know, if you look at the group of individuals who started kind of in Greensboro, the lunch counter protest, they were all students, college students.
Didn't they have the same things at stake here that young people today have in terms of getting an arrest record and being able to find a job?
Oh, certainly. But I think...
Well, but as African-American students, they were very limited in their social opportunities.
The Vietnam War protesters were predominantly white.
Yeah. But the key difference is there, you had a whole... student mobilization around these issues. So it wasn't just you as an isolated individual getting this record. You and all your friends and much of your campus was doing this together, and that was the power of it. That it
kind of came to define a generation for that particular perspective. But with this group, the study that was done by a Chapel Hill-based researcher showed that the average age was about 50. Mm-hmm. And that about a quarter were under, I think, 30 or 35. So, you know, there is a range, but as the professor said, you know, these are folks that are probably going to skew one way because they have already been through a lot and can certainly afford to take the time off to deal with the court issues. I mean, just now, I think it was yesterday, the first round of arrest were in court, and they've got to go back, I think it's in September, to deal with.
Yeah, the average age of these demonstrators is reported to be around 50. How does this correlate with the Tea Party movement? They were older, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the University of North Carolina Research Department also says, somebody at the University of North Carolina did research on this, they also say that 80% of these people are white, mm-hmm. 17% are black, and this is being organized by the NAACP, 6% are Hispanic. You know, these white 50-year-olds sound like GOP bread and butter.
Well, it's the continuation of the movements that we just talked about, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. The baby boomers have been fighting this stuff for the past generation. And so one reason we see them out in force is because they have experience with these type of movements, protests. It's not a big a hurdle to get out there and do it again as it is for a younger person for whom this all seems very strange and threatening and is a big step to protest at all, let alone let yourself be arrested for it.
In the Huffington Post, Dr. Purdy, you wrote, because North Carolina refused the Obamacare Medicaid expansion, I ended up in handcuffs in the Wake County Detention Center. Obviously, you see this as a moral issue. Is that correct?
Well, I suppose so. I as a personal matter, I am not a big one for the using the language of morality in public, but I very much respect the decision the NAACP organizers have made, which the panelists were very ably discussing before, to set the stakes in this way. And when you come down to it, I do, actually. I guess I can't avoid it. I opened with that line in the Huffington Post piece because I think that each person who's out there, and out on the lawn in particular, those who are not getting arrested, I see quite a diversity of age and attitude, you know, cultural style, as much as you can read from what people are wearing and so on. A lot of kinds of folks showing up, including a lot of younger folks. So for me, the trigger really was the decision that I had to do it was based on reflecting that the refusal to accept the Medicaid expansion, which I see really as refighting the Obamacare battle at the state level after losing it, after the Republicans lost it at the national level and then lost most of it at the Supreme Court level. That's among all the 14 states that at the time the statistic I saw was calculated were committed to refusing the expansion. The RAND Institute, which is a recognized, you know, mainstream, somewhat military-industrial-affiliated think tank, estimated about 19,000 people would avoidably die next year alone. And I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations just based on population of those states, and that's about 2,000 North Carolinians, you know, missing a diagnosis, missing preventive care, missing early treatment, and they don't make it. And statistics are impersonal. You know, someone said that one death is a tragedy and 1,000 deaths is a statistic, but statistics are built out of tragedies, and I think that we do need to call the state government on the human consequences of what it's doing, and it seems to me one way or another that is what people are going out there to do, and that is why the moral label in the end seems like the right one to us.
I want to come back to something you alluded to a second ago. You and others see many of these recent decisions by Raleigh lawmakers as attempts by House Republicans in Washington to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and by Republicans attempting to influence presidential elections going forward. Am I accurately stating your concerns about this?
That's quite right. I think it's part of – I think the North Carolina agenda is deeply connected to a national right-wing agenda. It's the agenda that lost in the last presidential election, and point for point is being refought on the state level now in terms of the structure. Yeah, please.
I have two political scientists here. I only have 45 seconds left. This is strategy.
Sure. Part of our federal system is that there are other opportunities. When you lose a battle in one venue, you move to the courts or the executive branch, or you move to the state or local government level. It's part of the open system that our guest was describing.
Is this unusual strategy? Is this something we haven't seen in recent years on the Democratic side, or is this an ongoing – is this the reason Republicans have been successful recently?
I think both sides are seeing their opportunities and they're taking them.
Okay. We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more with Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, and Dr. Jed Purdy, professor of law at Duke University, who has participated in these Moral Monday protests. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, blood supplier to 21 of the region's hospitals. Local donors help meet blood needs as the summer supplies drop and demand increases. CBCC.us. Brazilians have taken to the streets to protest rising prices, high taxes, and government corruption. What the demonstrations mean for Latin America's biggest economy coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. And we'll continue our conversation about our own set of protests up in Raleigh when we come back. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, a good way to jump into the conversation. We're coming right back.
Norris Cole has one. So does Usher. Even our own Kai Ryssdal kind of has one. A classic hairstyle is making a comeback.
Well, the sides are usually like faded very close. And then the top is like a pencil eraser. Like it goes straight up, you know, but it's usually flat on the top.
I'm Sarah Gardner. The return of the high top fade next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Moral Monday protests going on up in Raleigh. There was one yesterday. I believe it was the eighth week in a row. Over 100 people arrested yesterday, bringing the total over the last 8 weeks to around 600. Among them, Dr. Jed Purdy, our guest from West Virginia, who's actually a professor of law at Duke University. In our studio here at Spirit Square, Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College and Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte, both political scientists. We asked our Facebook and Twitter followers if they think getting arrested in protests is effective. And here are some of the answers. Kat tweets, "You lose your impact and your voice when you get arrested. No one will listen to you in jail. Plus, it's fuel for Art Pope and Civitas." Art Pope is the supposedly the Karl Rove of the McCrory administration, and Civitas is
a conservative leaning think tank based in Raleigh.
Anyway, they
funded by Art Pope.
Funded by Art Pope.
And so Kat says it's fuel for Art Pope and Civitas to splash your mugshot, which has happened, and personal info via the web for the whole world to see. Dr. Purdy, was your mugshot splashed on the website?
You know, I actually checked last night before I went to bed. I don't think they've tracked it down yet. Okay. But a lot of other people's mugshots are, and the rest of my information is up on the Civitas site.
As an arrestee, what's your reaction to Kat's tweet?
With respect, I don't agree at all. I think that if it ever became true that civil disobedience cost you your credibility, we would have lost something. Because, as I said before, it is a really central part of the constitutional compact that the country makes with itself, that people, as the guests were saying earlier, have a way to express a strong commitment to a dissenting view in a way that is within the bounds of civil and peaceful discourse, but raises the stakes by saying, "We're taking this very seriously, and we want people to pay attention and think twice." I think it's part of our lexicon. And I just quickly, I think that if we accepted otherwise, then that database would be doing its job. The database is trying to make protesters at best look ridiculous and illegitimate. And my view is that there is not a thing to be ashamed about in appearing on the Civitas RSD database.
I think part of it also is thinking about who the audiences are for the protest. The protesters really aren't going to convince Art Pope. You know, Art Pope can
and the people that support Civitas.
They can get what they want through traditional lobbying, through financing elections. The other audience here is the public at large in North Carolina to draw their attention to what the protesters find to be inappropriate about the General Assembly is doing and trying to move public opinion more broadly to register their discontent with what the legislature's doing.
It's interesting that we always have negative viewpoints of protests and protestors in this country, even though we are founded on that type of activity. And as a citizen, there are only certain ways that you can have a voice. You can vote. Mm-hmm. You can run for office. You can write letters to the editor. And you can protest.
And you can
contribute to campaigns. So this seems to be part of the American process. And yet we have a tweet from Bonnie who says the effectiveness of these protests is little. The protesters who are way too passionate about whatever they are protesting, it's not even a little effective.
Well, I mean, I would look back to 2009, what the Tea Party was able to accomplish. And, you know, they engaged in protest. They engaged in bringing awareness to their particular slant on important issues that they felt concerned about. And they had an impact in 2010. And so I think, you know, yes, this is a Raleigh base. This is a North Carolina-centric base. Mm-hmm. We've seen other states, Wisconsin in particular, even though that gained national reputation and recognition, the governor still won a recall election. But it allows people that opportunity to vent, as Jed said, and keep the system going. I mean, we don't want to pent up that frustration because we know what human nature can devolve into.
And I think if it's only isolated protests, yeah, probably they're not terribly effective. But if it becomes part of a larger organizing strategy, gets people involved in elections to vote, to talk to their neighbors about it, and you change the people in the legislature, exactly. That's when it becomes effective from a public policy perspective.
Exactly right. If I may, there's a slogan that the protesters have liked using, falsely attributed to Gandhi. I'm sure you've heard it. First they ignore you, then they make fun of you, then they fight you, then you win. And that's unduly optimistic. That's not usually how it works out. But I think that it is true that every protest begins with being ignored and proceeds, if it's lucky, to being made fun of. So we've gotten that far. And then beyond that, there is simply no knowing. I think these things are like throwing a rock in the water and seeing where the ripples go.
I mean, but I suppose it could be argued that these protests in Raleigh that we've been seeing over the past 8 Mondays are in response to the Tea Party protests of several years ago. And you wrote, Dr. Purdy, in the Post, the Huffington Post, that the Moral Monday protests have been chances to explain how the Tea Party agenda adds up to a vision of a society, a libertarian, privatized, yet punitively moralistic one, and a chance to articulate a progressive alternative committed to equality, tolerance, and mutual care. Do you feel, does anyone feel, that the protesters and that these protests have been able to articulate that point of view?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think the protests are a beginning to articulating that alternative. I completely agree with myself. You read. That is, I think that when people say that the protesters are against everything the legislature is doing, so they're unfocused, I think what they're actually trying to do is to say that there is a whole picture of policymaking and of the role of government in society that they're pursuing, you know, quite legitimately. That's one of the things that politics is about. But we have a different view, and to your question, we're working on exactly how you express that. And some parts of it are easy. I think most people involved in the protest probably have the view that basic access to health care should be a right of citizenship rather than a privilege handed out by the market. I think most of us probably feel that if you just drop people at the starting line at age 1 or age 5 or even age 12 or age 18, that they won't have a fair shot. And I think most of us think that there is more to living in a society together than competition and rewarding the efficient, that those are important values, but that community and mutual caretaking and a measure of equality are also important values. But I think, in fact, that progressives, my view, which lots of people in the protest may not share, is that progressives in this society, and really progressives all over the democratic world, are
is that small d small excuse me is that the doctor is that small d Democrat?
Yes, sir. That is small d Democrat.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That,
go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh no. I'm glad to leave it at that. I think progressives across the U.S., across Northern Europe, and in the emerging democracies are all trying to figure out what relation between government and market, what level of social solidarity and responsibility, what kind of individual responsibility we're aiming for. But I think in some ways, the states famously have always been the laboratories of democracy and the laboratories of policy. That's what the Raleigh legislature is at work on, making North Carolina a place to experiment with one kind of policy. And I think that the protests on a political level are another kind of experiment, trying to figure out what we say in answer to that, that combines the moral and biblical themes of caretaking and compassion and mutual obligation with the language that's more natural to me, which is the constitutional language about equal citizenship, equal participation in government, and equality before the law, and trying to spell out what that means concretely in terms of what laws we make and how we live together.
And you need a healthy debate. I mean, in a democratic republic, you need to hear both sides of particular issues. And this is the way, you know, with the minority numbers that the Democrats have in both the House and in the Senate, they're not going to get their policy views heard. They're not going to get them adopted. They're not going to have them transformed into law. This is the way to have that conversation that they feel they can't have in the General Assembly.
But will it result in anything when the numbers aren't there?
Well, it gives you the opportunity to start to inform the electorate that, again, we will have in a year and a half come back to the voting booth and to say whether I ratify and accept these changes or whether I want to hear more from the other side.
But given the way the districts were redrawn, which some allege has led to this Republican juggernaut, in the state legislature, is that even something that's possible? You can get as many voters to go into the booth as you can drive there, but sure. Can you get candidates elected?
That's the hard part, and that's the insurance policy that I think the Republicans have. The issue that they have to be concerned, Republicans have to be concerned about, is the demographic changes that are going on in this state as we speak right now, and we're going to start to see some possible transformations. You got to lay the groundwork now in order to win future elections.
There's been a lot of discussion nationally about the Republicans ignoring demographic realities that are sweeping toward us like a tsunami over the next 10 to 15 years. Is the same thing happening here?
I think the real risk for the Republicans in the short term is if independent, unaffiliated voters decide that the Republicans are too extreme for them, are not listening, are not interested in compromise, but are pushing their own ideological agenda and really aren't interested in the average person in the state. And, you know, kind of swear off the Republican brand. Mm. It's in these stacked districts, it's going to be independents in mass turning against the Republicans that would flip them.
Got a lot of listeners who want to participate in this through emails and also a couple of people on the phone. And one of the people on the phone wants to disagree with one of our tweeters, Paul in Mint Hill. Welcome. You're on WFAE.
Yes. Hi. Good morning, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pick up the phone and call after I heard those two messages from those people who were, in essence, trying to negate your actions. You know, I want to tell you as a person who, you know, every day I turn on the radio and hear more and more disheartening news about what the current legislature is doing in Raleigh. And I have to tell you, I take heart when I hear about your protests and what you're doing. And if I were in a position to go to Raleigh and get arrested, I would. Unfortunately, right now I'm unemployed, and it isn't possible for me to do that. I would also like to throw in that because I'm unemployed, I don't necessarily blame the government, minorities, God, anybody else. You know, what I do is on me. So, I just want to let you guys know that what you're doing does have an impact. And hopefully it will show up in the polls next time.
Paul, thank you for your call. Let me go to somebody who identifies themselves as Gotham in Charlotte. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. My question and then comment based on my own experience having been there yesterday. The question is, how this mobilization, which is non-electoral, non-party, going to translate into 15 to 18 months? Any dynamic change in the legislative numbers, especially given reducing reality. And I agree with my predecessor caller that to go there yesterday and see people, I saw at least 40 senior African-Americans, some people disabled, Hispanic-American workers, people coming from all the way from Asheville protesting privatization of water. It was just amazing to be North Carolinian in such a diverse age, gender, and color range that gave us hope. And then people danced, people sang, people had funny, witty play cards. And I think all that is going back to various parts of North Carolina and really shaking up things. So right. I really feel, yes.
Well, go ahead. I will finish your thought. We have to move on.
I'm not usually the protest type or the singing, dancing type, but I also came back with the energy and enthusiasm. And I think that was the case with lots of other people.
Okay. We thank you for your call. We kind of addressed the first part of his question about the impact this might have down the line at elections. Jim on Facebook says, no doubt that being arrested is effective. Where would this country be without folks who put themselves on the line to do the right thing? Lou emails, the fact that you are talking about Moral Monday and the protest on today's show demonstrates that those getting arrested have made a difference. We are talking and... isn't that the point? Jim on Facebook says, perhaps I'm too cynical, but when Governor McCrory says these people are outsiders protesting on Moral Mondays, does it remind folks of what the Southern governors used to say when folks were protesting for civil rights? Didn't they say back then that those folks were all outsiders and agitators? Isn't that what's always said about these people? No matter what they're protesting, no matter where it is?
Yeah. Well, unless they're protesters on your side.
Yeah, I am 53-year-old former Republican who stands with you. John emails, can the redrawn districts be challenged either under the U.S. Constitution or under any voter rights laws, that if you are a Democrat and can get a candidate elected, can't get a candidate elected because of the demographics, that you have no legal representation because your voice will never be heard?
Supreme Court's going to hand down a Voting Rights Act case here either today or this week.
Okay. We have to move on because we're completely out of time. Dr. Jed Purdy, professor of law at Duke University, one of the protesters and one of the people arrested. When will your case come up?
My court date is August 13th, but I understand that that's going to be pretty pro forma, and then if they're proceeding with the prosecution, then a more substantial date will be set for the fall.
Okay. Dr. Michael Bitzer is associate professor and department chair of politics and history and acting provost of Catawba College, and Dr. Eric Heberlig, associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte.